The Money Cafe is brought to you by Eureka Report, your one-stop shop for all things finance. To sign up for your free 15-day trial, head to eurekareport.com.au. Now it's time to enjoy today's episode.
Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, finance presenter on ABC News and columnist for The New Daily.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, contributor at Eureka, founder of Crikey, shareholder advocate and City of Manningham councillor.
And we are the Money Cafe.
And the sun is out at Le Clec.
And it stopped raining.
For a minute. First time in 3 weeks. It's just shocking weather.
I just got back from Sydney this morning and I think it's about 10 degrees colder in Melbourne.
They nailed us on the races, didn't they? 13 degrees on Cup Day and sunshine in Sydney. I mean, that was marketing heaven for those New South Welshmen.
Yes.
It's funny, true. We had our mayoral ball at Manningham last Friday night and I hosted Matthew Elliott on our table, the former test opening batsman who's just come in. God bless him, as the volunteer president of the Fitzroy Doncaster Premier Cricket Club in Manningham. And 4 weeks they haven't bowled a ball in anger. The cricket season. So the Victorian cricket season has lost the first month, every bit of it. The weather's been so bad. Do you know they play cricket in summer in winter in Queensland? Because they haven't.
That'd be right. Well, that's the dry season.
They haven't got a round ball sport, so they haven't got, the ovals aren't used because they're all playing rugby league and rugby union. So the ovals are spare. So they have a thriving winter turf cricket.
Yeah, because it's the dry season.
Yeah, whereas here we've got this hopeless one little synthetic thing in the whole of Melbourne, which is really low standard and not very popular because everyone's playing footy. Anyway.
Come on.
You've been tweeting up a storm about the Reserve Bank, you know, giving Elon Musk some extra advertising dollars by driving traffic and selling outrage. What outrage have you been selling on Twitter against our governor?
Well, it's just that there was a lot of attention paid to his speech the other night in Hobart, where he talked about inflation being an evil and a scourge and how interest rates are going to go much higher. And I simply pointed out that he spent a year telling us that interest rates weren't going to rise for 3 years. And so it's probably best not to pay too much attention to what he says. But I then subsequently tweeted, and everyone went, oh, geez, what a burn, you know, Christ, Alan Cole is getting stuck in a Phil Lowe and all this stuff. And there was plenty of action, plenty of comment. But I actually tweeted after that. I said, the point is that forward guidance and the words of central bankers have become part of monetary policy. So it's one of the tools of central bankers. And so what they say is not to be taken as a prediction, but it's to be taken as an attempt to influence behaviour now.
Yeah.
So he's just trying to...
It's policy by marketing. It's policy by words.
So he's trying to
managing
suppress...
managing expectations.
He's trying to suppress behaviour now by what he says, as well as by increasing interest rates.
He may as well say, stop spending, everyone, or I'll put rates up again.
That's exactly
what he's saying.
That is what he's saying.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit like the old NCSC before ASIC came into place when they only had a budget of $6 million to regulate the whole of Australia. Henry Bosch, or you know, Big Ears Bosch, it was just regulation by press release because he had no budget. So the NCSC says Alan Bond is dodgy and Alan, you've got to stop doing this because they just didn't have any money or lawyers to do anything.
Yeah, well, there you are.
I think
Philip Lowe shouldn't, you know, I think the saying that interest rates aren't going to go up for 3 years or until 2024 was a bad mistake.
One of the all-time stuff-ups by a central bank.
But it also was forward guidance, monetary policy by forward guidance. He was trying to influence behaviour at the time.
Yeah.
He wasn't actually making a promise or a prediction.
But the influence that he had was to create a ridiculous housing bubble and put tens of thousands of dollars heavily into debt, buying overpriced property because everyone thought they had an interest rate promise until 2024.
So that turned out to be
class action.
That turned out to be a bit of a whoopsie.
Class action, you reckon? You know that Green Day song, When September Comes?
Well, oh, I'm
Phil,
afraid I don't.
Phil Lowe's contract comes up next September and we're all waiting for when September comes so we can get someone else in the job.
Yes.
Bye-bye, Mr. Lowe.
Now, speaking of Twitter, what do you reckon about Musk's latest efforts in relation to Twitter?
Well, I mean, I think he's absolutely mad. He's no longer the richest man in the world because he's lost tens of millions of dollars already. So he's already written a check for $44 billion US. Then he's had to write a check for $42 million to pay out the CEO who he fired. Now it's just going to be bleeding cash because
is that right? It cost him $42 million
to fire the CEO. Yeah,
jeez.
Yeah, that's right. Now he's going to be bleeding cash because, you know, advertisers like General Motors and others are not going to go help a rival, and people are pausing their advertising spend because he's so reckless. Do you know that he retweeted a conspiracy theorist saying that Paul Pelosi got attacked by a gay lover? That was the most disgraceful thing I think I've ever seen.
Did he retweet that?
He retweeted it. It had 80,000 likes. He got smashed for a reckless retweet of fake news, and which all the conspiracy theories liked, and then he deleted it. But he showed himself to be wholly unsuitable to be in charge of Twitter with that single tweet.
I agree with you. I think he could destroy Twitter.
I think that it was like when we sold Crikey, when we were running Crikey, we always had blimey.com in the back pocket. So if crikey.com fell over, you set up blimey.com. I reckon someone's going to set up Blitter. All the Twitter people are going to go off and do a startup called Blitter or, you know, Quitter or whatever, and they'll just copy it. Everyone will go over there, and he'll continue to burn cash, and this will be the biggest regret of his life. But it's all about the power of him. He's a look-at-me narcissist, and everyone's looking at him. I've just probably got kicked off Twitter for calling him a narcissist. So can we delete that, Greg? I might lose my platform if that gets out there. Anyway,
I'm sure he's an avid listener to Money Cafe, of course. Yeah. Now you've been doing blizzards of annual meetings. Unbelievable number of annual meetings you've attended or fired in questions at, including this morning Zip. So tell me about the Zip annual meeting.
Well, Zip was like Afterpay. They started at the same time in the buy now, pay later space. And Afterpay
failed to sell.
Correct. So Afterpay got lucky when Twitter founder Jack Dorsey went mad and stupidly gave 18% of his company, Squareblock, to the Afterpay shareholders, who, if they were smart enough to get out before this recent tech wreck, have still made plenty of cash, even though Afterpay never did and never will make a profit. And poor old Zip is battling on with the flawed business model of taking massive unsecured credit risk. So they had bad debt write-offs last year of $228 million.
So I imagine the shareholders, upset shareholders, were queuing up to ask questions.
Well,
I
was the only one of the 121,000 shareholders who actually asked questions during the formal.
121,000
because all the speculators on you know, the tech boom, buy an iPower later, everyone was piling in. So the voter turnout was only 22% today. Only 22% of the stock voted. Because about 80% of the stock's owned by these 121,000 retail speculators, and all the smart money have already run for the exits.
And all those people, all the people who are still in there have moved on and lost interest, right? They don't care anymore. They've written off their
correct. Hence,
money.
They weren't banging the door down at today's virtual AGM with no physical
and
presence.
And you were.
And I asked 12 questions and strung the meeting out to about 80 minutes. And look, it was quite good. They answered all of them. Diane Smith-Gander, the chair, did a good job. Larry Diamond, the founder, you know, I said, how many shares have you sold? Have you got margin loans? You know, those sort of personal questions that people hate to answer. So he said he's only sold about 15% of his stock over the years. There's no margin loans to speak of. But look, the stock, you know, I got the auditor to speak as well because they wrote off the losses are $750 million and they wrote down $650 million last year. But they're still claiming they've got net assets of $1.2 billion and the market cap's $450 million with the stock at 50 cents. So I'm going, come on, Mr. Auditor, get up. You know, you've signed off. There's a missing $700 million. What's going on? Why did you sign the accounts? The write-offs should have been double. And like all auditors, he gets up. And what did he say? The accounts are drawn up in accordance with the accounting standards and sits down.
Tell me, Stephen, having attended the annual meeting and listened to their answers to your penetrating questions, are they going to make it? Will they survive?
I mean, I don't see how giving unsecured loans to millennials and saying, isn't it great we've got our write-offs on our $8 billion loan book down to less than 2%? Aren't we doing great? I mean, they claim they're competing with credit cards, but Visa and MasterCard do not take credit risk. Buy now, pay later will never work because they're taking credit risk. They've lost hundreds of millions of dollars, including $228 million in 1 year, last year. And so the model is flawed. You cannot give unsecured loans to big spending millennials and then let them write off the debt without copping a credit black eye or a black mark that means that they'll actually be honest and pay the money back.
So they won't.
Zip is a void, in my view.
A void?
A void. Stocks at 50 cents. Someone should take them over. They've got a good database. You know, they can help merchants with marketing, which is the only upside with Afterpay. But the fundamental model of a lending business taking credit risk to millennials, going on spendathons in shopping centres, it was always a stock-selling scheme. Billions have and will be lost. They'll never make cash profits. And all those millennials have said, thanks for the free lunch.
There you go, everybody. You've heard it here first.
It's a bit savage, I guess, wasn't it?
Possibly not first.
It was a good AGM, so I enjoyed it.
There we are.
I must admit, I did seven in one day last week. Wesfarmers, South 32, Data 3, Globe Internationals, EGM. You know, Solly Lewis voted against the remuneration report 20 years in a row, triggering strikes at his surf and skatewear company, Globe International.
20 years in a row?
20 years in a row. And they're 69% owned by the three.
What's he doing? Why is he bothering?
He's an angry man. I mean, I did say at the meeting, the Hill brothers, there's three Hill brothers who are old skateboarders, you know, street skateboarders, who still own 69% of the company. So it's controlled by them. And Solly's been attacking them for 20 years, causing strikes. And so they had another spill meeting. The board got spilled. The three directors got re-elected yet again. And I said, is Solly ever talked to you? No. Do you ever talk to him? No. And I sort of said at the meeting, why doesn't he go and pick on the Murdochs or go and pick on...
Somebody who deserves being picked on.
The Wilson family at Reece, they own 63%. I mean, you cannot keep attacking a company which is majority controlled by someone. And what's the point? Anyway, but Domino's yesterday was great, the AGM. You know, they're the world's biggest pizza maker.
They say that.
Bigger than Pizza Hut.
Are they bigger than Pizza Hut?
They're the biggest.
Sure?
They're the biggest.
Yeah, right.
And Jack Cowan, he's just turned 80. He's a billionaire. And I said, Jack, you got any kids coming through? I mean,
yeah,
you can't keep serving through.
And
he said, well, my three daughters are all full-time mums.
Yeah, they're not interested.
My son is an overpaid money management executive who does sit on the Domino's Japan board. So he's obviously doing money management up in Japan. But Jack hasn't got a succession plan for his billions, but he's done a great job building Domino's.
Well, their pizzas are okay, I reckon.
They're everywhere, aren't they? Every suburb's got a Domino's. It's like 7-Eleven. They're just absolutely everywhere.
Yeah, but they're all over the world.
All over the world. 13 markets, 3,800 stores
and
in 13 countries.
Are their pizzas in France and America and all that stuff the same? Are they the same pizzas?
Oh, I think they've got a global formula they've rolled out. I keep saying to them, you know, where are all the Italians? I mean, how have you out-Italianed the Italians? Because there's no Italians on their board.
There's no Italians in Pizza Hut either. I mean, the pizza pizzas.
There should be a global Italian company which is king of Papagino's or something, which is king of pizzas. So the Italians are useless at business, clearly, if they've been outsmarted by a bunch of Brisbane boys to become the world's biggest pizza maker.
They probably reckon Domino's pizzas aren't really pizzas.
Well,
and are not.
It's a tribute to the franchise model. They do rough industrial relations. They're copying a class action at the moment. I said, you know, how many unions have you got? How many enterprise agreements? And they go, no enterprise agreements, no unions, and we pay the award wage, which is precisely what JB Hi-Fi said last week at their AGM as well. That's the retailers that make money, the ones that go tough on their workforce.
Yes. Now, listen, we got anything else to say? Do you want to talk about Rupert Murdoch?
Oh, look, just the fact that he's working from home in Montana. He's signed an official agreement with
his home's in Montana.
He's moved into the ranch that he bought off the Koch brothers, I think.
Has he got a woman now?
No, no, he's a 91-year-old bachelor, four times failed marriage man. Family's worth $30 billion. He's still executive chairman, overpaid at $50 million a year across two companies, but he's working from home. And his son, Lachlan, is working from home in Sydney. So you've got this company, Fox, out of control, Fox News, run by the talent. And you've got old Rupert sitting in there in Montana, young Lachlan chasing his kids in Sydney. They even said on the Fox call this week, you know, I can tell you that, you know, the pizza market's going very well based on the number of pizza deliveries that come to my home in Sydney. How he runs
Are they Domino's
Fox
pizzas?
I don't know, but he just said, my kids keep ordering pizzas on this conference call talking about the Fox earnings. And so I think that they're going to try and merge Fox and News Corp just to make it less complicated, but I don't see how they can sustain that model. And interesting, Paddy Manning's book on the Murdochs this week claims that when Rupert dies, the other three kids are going to do a palace coup and give Lachlan the boot.
Huh.
Which is interesting.
It is.
Because the Murdoch Trust has requested the merger, and the Murdoch Trust is the four adult kids. So clearly there's a majority. So
in the TV show, the kids all got together and got done by the dad.
Yeah, yeah.
So
well, dad's too old to do that.
And so dad's too old for that, right.
Yeah, that's and he's
right.
had to deal so with Brian, with each divorce, he's had to deal with his kids. And so the kids
Brian
got
Cox,
control.
Brian Cox as Logan Roy was not that old. No. And he certainly wasn't working from home in Montana.
No. He's done a great job, Rupert. There is no one like him. He does sit atop the world's most powerful family. But I just wish we didn't have Brexit, second Iraq war, climate change denialism and Donald Trump, which are all the things that he's responsible for.
Yeah, so I just hope we didn't have Rupert Murdoch.
Well, I agree. I think he's been a toxic. If Turnbull's right. The biggest destroyer of damager of American democracy and the world's greatest defamer.
I should.
Mate, he's a good bloke.
I should tweet about him. That'll teach him.
Well, the AGM of Fox is tomorrow morning at 1 a.m, but it's a physical meeting in Los Angeles
on the Fox
lot at the Zantac Theatre. And to get in, you've got to pre-register about a month in advance, and then you've got to meet in a shopping centre and get on the company bus. And I've done that 3 or 4 times, and they only get about 6 shareholders there. And one time I was in the toilet and I heard a staff member say to another bloke, "We've done everything we can possibly do to turn this into a non-event." So no one turns up.
Okay, let's do some questions. Mike says, "I felt like you and James were so close to discussing the elephant in the room last week but just skirted around it, i.e. interest rate rises possibly not being able to tame inflation. If we continue to have supply-side shocks moving forward and war aside, climate disasters will continue, plus the fact 65% of the population don't have a mortgage. Why are we expecting it to work? The RBA only has a hammer, but it's like whacking someone on the side of the head with it while you set fire to their life savings. It's unnecessary pain for no gain." Well, yes, that's right. But, you know, the thing to remember about monetary policy is that interest rates are a price, like everything else, but it's one of the only prices, if not the only one, so it's one of the few prices that is not actually in the consumer price index. So they're able to put it up without actually directly influencing inflation.
Yes.
It indirectly causes prices to go up, it's true, by forcing businesses to put their prices up so they can pay the interest on their debt. But the reason monetary policy works is because borrowers tend to cut back more than savers spend.
Yes.
Obviously, higher interest rates cause pain for borrowers and benefit savers, but the borrowers cut back more than the savers spend.
Yeah, it is the most effective way to reduce demand when you've got runaway inflation.
Well, a more effective way would be to put up petrol prices or electricity prices.
Governments have given up on using fiscal policy to reduce demand.
I mean, that's right.
I would rather they kept interest rates at 1% and went for massive tax increases to try and pay off the debt and deliver a surplus.
Yeah, so you could do something like temporarily increase the GST.
Correct. GST to 15%, no exemptions. Until inflation's under control, even though that measure would increase inflation.
Well, that's the problem. See, interest rates are not in the CPI, whereas GST is in the CPI.
Triple council rates all over the country for 3 years, because that's a good tax on the rich, tax on the property owners. But I agree that everyone's given up on fiscal
policy,
and they're one trick pony now with
fiscal
policy
has been killed by neoliberalism because
money printing too. Yeah,
oh no, but. Fiscal policy doesn't work anymore because neoliberalism means that everyone's always trying to cut taxes and reduce government spending. So there's this constant downward pressure.
Until you get to Liz Truss and you cause a run on the pound and a spike in interest rates.
Well,
that's where the printing reaches its limit because markets do have a limit. Now, Nick says, "Hope you had a win on Tuesday at the Cup."
I had a win because I didn't bet.
Yeah. Well, I bet $10 each way on the Will to Fight and I lost. But I did an 8-venue tour of all the gambling venues of Manningham during the Cup.
Oh, yeah.
The 42 people on the pokies did not leave them to even watch the Cup. And that was a very sad thing to look at.
It was.
Most of them are on their own, lonely, addicted, and didn't even get out of the trance to watch the Cup. And that's how $14 billion a year gets lost on 200,000 poker machines in 5,000 venues across the country. It's a disgrace.
I had a win because the winner of the Cup gold trip gave me the opportunity for a pun on the news that night.
You've never done that before, have you?
No, it was the traditional, as I said in the news, it was the traditional Cup Day laboured pun, which was which was a graph of gold's price with the heading gold's trip.
Captain,
get it? You get it.
Yes, Captain Pun. Captain. You've done more. I mean, who's done more puns on television than you?
Nobody.
You are the pun king.
Pun king.
Yeah. No, you've done a great job. You're the master.
Rhymes with Sun King.
I love the story you told me the other day about you keep having powerful men coming up to you saying that my wife loves your ABC spots.
Oh, I had a beauty this morning. I'm getting off a plane. I was in the plane coming back from Sydney this morning. And this guy was chatting to me on the plane, clearly recognised me. And then in the concourse, after we get off, he comes up to me and says, oh, look, I'm really sorry. I mistook you for somebody else. He says, I thought you were Alan Kohler. I said, I am. It was great.
Actually, I once had a relationship with the... nice lady called Gwen Robinson, who was the Financial Times' Australian correspondent. And I was sitting at a dinner with a friend of hers, Colleen Ryan, who was the editor of the Fin Review. And I just resigned as the Daily Telegraph's chief of staff. And she was saying, oh, what do you do? And I said, I'm a journalist at the Daily Telegraph, and I'm going to go off and go to England and buy a few shares in companies and ask questions at a few AGMs. And she said, oh, what, you're going to do a Stephen Mayne, are you? And I said, I am Stephen Mayne. And then she said, don't do that. Come and write Rear Window for me.
And?
So I said, yes. So
I went to England,
flew back and lasted 10 weeks at Rear Window before I ran off the cliff and tried to unseat Jeff Kennett as a political candidate and a whistleblower.
Well, that was a brief episode of Sense, Stephen, if I may say.
Yes, anyway, but what happens when people don't know who you are? So
carry on with Nick's question.
I'm confused by the lack of talk about price elasticity when discussing inflation at present. It seems that all the products that are rising in price are those which would be bought regardless of the cost, food, petrol, rent. Discretionary products appear to be all around the same cost as 2 years ago. I can still buy a PlayStation, a big TV and a BMW for roughly the same price. What result does the RBA want with these rate rises?
It wants to crush demand so that inflation generally falls, you know. It's not a question of what individual prices are doing, or PlayStations or TVs.
Yeah.
PlayStations and TVs, yes, electronic goods have come down in price because of...
thank you, China. 25 years of low-cost labour and technology and productivity. But BMWs have gone up because all cars have gone up for a while.
So the RBA is not keeping an eye on JB Hi-Fi. It's keeping an eye on the Australian Bureau of Statistics.
That's right. And those Coles results last week showed that the food was the worst. They had 8% fresh food inflation in their Coles result. And even just overnight, the likes of Proctor's and Mondelez in the US have been jacking up their prices big time and really enjoying the remarkable brand loyalty where they're not seeing much of a loss of market share or loss of volume, even as they jack up prices like 14%.
Because the overall inflation rate of 7.3% is the average of 8.4% non-discretionary prices.
Yeah.
Inflation,
yeah,
and 5% discretionary.
Yeah.
So the stuff we have to buy
is going up more.
It's going up more.
Yeah. How about petrol this week? From 171 to 215 overnight, a litre for unleaded. So
Jim says, in your opinion, what is stopping the Albanese government from implementing a Norwegian-style resources tax on our gas, iron ore, etc. resources? Surely the incremental revenue raised would go a substantial way to meeting the increased spending needs of the country.
Look, this really annoys me, this question from Jim. It's a classic lefty question. It assumes that these big multinationals are not paying much tax. We have a 30% corporate tax rate, which is one of the highest in the world.
But they all get out of it.
No, they don't. Last December, when the MOEFO came out, they predicted corporate tax revenue of $90 billion in 2022-23. Jim Chalmers last week lifted that figure by 41% or $37 billion to $127 billion. So we've had a $37 billion corporate tax windfall in our budget forecast for this financial year over a 10-month period because all these commodity giant petrol gas types are paying masses of corporate tax at 30 cents in the dollar. So we are getting the windfall, and Jim is saying that we should have sovereign risk and broken promises. And no sensible democratic country can risk sovereign risk with broken contracts or get elected and break all their promises. So stop calling for people to break their promises, including the third stage of the tax cuts.
Cop that, Jim, you lefty, you.
Correct. There's another Jim here.
The ABS says, it might be the same Jim.
Yeah, go again, Jim. The ABS says 35% of Australian households have a mortgage. How many of these households have a nominal amount in their mortgage? I suspect the Kohler household. What proportion of this 35% are retaining their mortgage as a line of credit, paying negligible amounts, and would not be substantially impacted by recent interest rate rises? Well, Kohler, you're in on this rort. It's not a real mortgage you've got. You've just got play money with your mortgage, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're in the 35% of having a mortgage when it's not a real mortgage.
Yeah, but I'm impacted because my kids have got real mortgages.
Yeah, but you know, Jim's basically
on the bank of Dad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, good on you for that. But probably the true figure is 30%. 30% of people have real mortgages and no share portfolios on the side outside of their compulsory super, i.e. they're all in on housing. They're
That's
battling.
Right,
they're
they
having
are.
Kids,
and they're battling.
Australia.
And it's difficult.
It's difficult, correct.
And you know, 35% is a lot of households.
It is.
At 3.5 million households, yeah, right? But if all of those households are in strife, then the country's in strife.
Yeah, but all residential property in Australia has probably dropped from 10 trillion to 9 trillion, right, with this 10% correction. So that's 6 trillion of unmortgaged residential households. That is an enormous store of wealth in Australia.
That's irrelevant.
Shared and enjoyed by the top 20%.
It's irrelevant to the situation of the economy. Steve says, I hold a fair number of iron ore stocks in my SMSF. What are your thoughts on our government's response to a Chinese invasion of Taiwan? Will we impose embargoes on the sale of iron ore and other commodities to China? No one seems to be addressing the consequences of this increasingly likely event.
Well, this is where we've got our foot on China's throat. That we have more leverage over China than any other country in the world. If we turn off the iron ore tap, their billion... tons a year of steel grinds to a halt unless the Brazilians give them
the lot. They haven't got the African mine going sufficiently yet.
Yeah, so we have enormous leverage over them, and if we did do that, I think they'd invade.
They'd invade Australia?
Yeah, because we'd be breaking contracts and stealing hundreds of billions of dollars off them because they also own large equity stakes in many of these mines.
So if we imposed an embargo on China because it invades Taiwan, Stephen Mayne says...
They'll invade us.
They'll invade
us. If they're invading Taiwan, why wouldn't they invade us too? Spread the war out.
Well, because they need... That's right. They need the iron ore.
The Americans would take them out and take them on.
But it is...
World War
III. I mean, big picture, Steve, is that the world is dividing into two spheres, America and China. We are on America's side. It is going to, in the long, medium to long term, cause a problem.
I'm still hoping that Russia is going to flip Japan style at the end of the Second World War. There's going to be a coup against Putin. Navalny will get out of prison and become president, and then Russia will join the Quad and then help encircle China, and then the whole world can contain China that way.
There you go.
Now, Jenny says, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on Sirrah Resources. They have a graphite mine in Mozambique and are currently experiencing difficulties with employees and contractors. Apparently, graphite is an important component of lithium batteries. Do you think this is a stock worth considering? I would appreciate your views on this, Mr. Kohler.
In fact, there's more graphite in lithium batteries than there is lithium. And they should be called graphite batteries.
Wow. So lithium's got the marketing edge there.
Well, they're called lithium batteries, but in fact, there's more graphite.
They're graphite
in them.
Batteries.
And
That's
they're graphite batteries. So, yes, graphite is really important. People who have got a decent deposit of graphite, I mean, there's tons of graphite in the Earth's crust, but, you know, there's graphite and graphite. You need to have good quality graphite. They've got a mine in Mozambique which is actually producing graphite. They're losing tons of money still, even though they're producing graphite. They've had a strike. They walked off the job, but they've just recently informed the stock exchange that the Mozambique workers are back at work, have ended the strike, but there's clearly a problem. They've clearly got sort of bolshy workers there. Mm. They've done
I wonder
a deal.
If they're all on the award over there, do you reckon? Like JB Hi-Fi and Domino's.
They need to get back on the Mozambique award.
Are unions even legal in Mozambique? I hope so.
I've got no idea, but
I bet they haven't got a $25 minimum wage.
But they're not that happy. But anyway, Sirrah's also got a graphite deposit in Louisiana, which is probably a better place to have it because it's closer to the markets. They've done a deal with LG, which is a battery maker, over the Louisiana deposit. So, look, I don't know. I don't like the way it's losing money still, but they've got $135 million in the bank, so they're not going to run out of money in a hurry.
At the end of the day, the world needs tons of lithium and graphite for batteries, so they're going to go well. But I never forget the boss of Mineral Resources, the billionaire boss of Mineral Resources, last year at the AGM said under his breath, have you ever tried to run a lithium mine? In other words, it's hard. So everyone's got lithium deposits. Try actually getting the processing up and profitably extracting it at scale. Not as easy as it sounds. Everyone can have a MOU with Tesla, but selling billions of dollars of lithium, another story.
I've got time for one more question.
Caroline.
My turn. Caroline says the Calix SPP opened last Wednesday and was looking very attractive, but on Friday, share price closed nearly 19% lower on the announcement that the Australian government has cancelled the carbon capture, use and storage hubs and technologies program. Before the cancellation, Calix was the recipient of $41 million in grants for two lime and cement decarbonisation projects. The government has now announced a new carbon capture technology grants program will open in 2023. My question is, do you think Calix is an attractive business?
Well, this is the reckless Barnaby Josh Morrison multi-billion dollar grant spray fest pre-election, where they picked winners and dished out literally billions of dollars to, you know, probably 30 public companies got, you know, 5 million plus grants. So Calix got 41 million. Albo and Chalmers have come in and gone, reckless waste, we'll clean it up and stop the rorts. And Calix have suffered a $41 million loss of grant. Shares have tumbled 19%. And that's interesting timing because the shares are today at 427. So that gives it a valuation of 747 million. The capital raising with Instos was a placement at 60 million at $4.55. So it's now out of the money. But the SPP, which is 20 million, has an alternative pricing of 2.5% discount to VWAP.
So VWAP being volume-weighted average price.
So the 7,000 retail shareholders who theoretically are being offered a chance to subscribe to $200 million worth of shares if they all write a cheque for $30,000, whatever the price on closing date, they'll get a 2.5% discount. And so that's not a bad discount. So if you want to top up, go for it.
And just big picture, I reckon Calix's technology is terrific. And I like... I mean, the thing about this Calix technology is that cement kilns are a real problem for, you know, carbon emissions, and they at least have come up with a solution to it. And nobody else that I'm aware of has done it. So, you know, and they've invented this. I think it's in Bacchus Marsh. It was invented.
Bacchus.
So some bloke in Bacchus Marsh discovered or invented
this. What if
it's
related to Rodney Marsh?
Bacchus.
That was his nickname.
That was
Bacchus
Marsh. No, that's right. Now you've put me off.
I'm going to buy some Calix shares because anything that's capped at 750 million is obviously an interesting top 200 company.
There you are. So we like Calix, Carolyn, and we've got to end now.
Now we're over time, but final point. I want to show you the proxy form for the upcoming AGL annual meeting. That is an absolute disgrace. That's meant to be a ballot paper you're looking at, and all over it you've got the board's recommendation saying vote for these people and vote against all these people. We need the Australian Electoral Commission to take over independently running contested corporate elections
because boards should
not be able to produce biased ballot papers like that and use unlimited amounts of company money to campaign for themselves.
We'd have to quadruple the budget of the Australian Electoral Commission.
No. If 10% of the shareholders petition for the AEC to run the ballot, then the company spends the money and appoints the AEC. Happens with union elections, happens all over the shop. Why are companies able to run their own election campaigns and produce massively biased ballot papers? If you go online and try and vote for AGL, there's all this vote against Grok's people, vote for our people. It's unfair, it's biased, it's been done against me 54 times and I'm sick of it. And
54 times
should be fair.
You see, everybody counts them up.
Even billionaires are copying
Stephen Mayne. Stephen Mayne, one thing you learn about Stephen Mayne if you know him is he never forgets.
But Grok is going to get three of their four candidates up. So the AGL board's going to go from 5 to 8. And the first time outside candidates have got on a board since Jeffrey Cousins at Telstra. And he went from rock thrower to happy contributor to the board club.
Okay, thanks everyone for listening to today's lively episode of The Money Cafe. I'll be back next week with James Thompson, so send in your questions to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. So until next week, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, finance presenter on ABC News and columnist for The New Daily.
I'm Stephen Mayne, Australia's most unsuccessful candidate, freelance contributor, shareholder activist, and still Manningham councillor for two more years.